I want to thank those people who have submitted questions so far for the lovely printing. You guys have done a great job at making this possible for me. All right, the first question is, to what extent is it a correct conception that new technology will lead to highly efficient, small power sources that will serve local, not long-distance customers, and render your project sadly obsolete?
So there are technologies that have been under development for decades, which are local or distributed. You know, one example is solar technology or fuel cell technology. These have been technologies that have been in development now. You see them being adopted to varying degrees, and they certainly serve a purpose. You know, they're generally renewable, and they certainly bring a benefit by being local. We're a long way from them rendering obsolete the transmission grid or large baseload generation. One of the primary issues with these small renewables is their ability to follow load in the fact that they are generally intermittent resources, which means when the sun is not shining or the wind is not blowing, you still have to have a base load source of electricity to keep the lights on as well as the transmission system to deliver it. So there's certainly a place for small-scale distributed generation today and for the next several decades. My view is we still need a robust and reliable transmission system as well as a base load fleet to meet customers' needs.
A follow-up to that question would be about storage. Sure. What's the state of technology development and storage for things like solar and things where you could generate a lot during the day, and how would you use it then?
Yeah, solar storage technology, again, it's been under development for decades. I think just now you're starting to see the first true commercial applications of it. Some utilities across the country are making investments in storage, either on a pilot or a small scale. There are no large-scale dependencies on storage. And it's for two reasons. First, we have to prove it out that it works technically and it provides the benefit that we hope to deliver. And the second is, again, price. It is cost prohibitive to rely on storage on a large scale, in essence, to meet the demands of customers. But like distributed technologies and like small-scale renewables, it's exciting. I think it holds promise in the future. We first have to prove it out technically, and then the price point has to come down so that customers still have a affordable source of electricity.
All right, new topic.
Yeah.
How is the publicity and promotion of the Northern Pass project being funded? Is it coming from ratepayers? Is Hydro-Quebec paying for it? Eversource shareholders? How is that happening?
Yeah, so for Eversource customers, and this is certainly true for the work we're doing today, but it's also true for the project itself, from the outset, we've made a commitment to New Hampshire that New Hampshire customers will not pay for any aspect of Northern Pass. And that remains the case, and it's certainly true for any costs we've incurred to date. The costs we've incurred to this point are really borne between our company and its shareholders, as well as our partner, Hydro-Quebec. To the extent our project actually is constructed and we put it into service, I showed earlier the relationship between us and Hydro-Quebec, that's how we will recover our costs, which is through the transmission support agreement, which has been approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That does not kick in until we have a project that's been permitted and has been constructed.
Next question has to do with, it's a fairly simple question. Why are the transmission towers so high?
Yeah, so I'm going to defer to one of our technical experts, probably Mr. Bose, who could better answer that.
Thank you. This is Ken Bose, Vice President of Engineering for Eversource. It's really down to the electrical safety codes that are in place. And to get it pertains to the electrical safety codes that are in place, in this case the National Electric Safety Code, which specifies that the clearance required between conductors, either AC or DC transmission, and also the distance between the conductors and the earth. So it's really a safety standard.
The next two questions relate to use of existing rights of way. As worded, the first version of that question is, can the new lines use existing transmission paths instead of cutting new trails? And the second one is specific to south of White Mountain National Forest. To what extent, actually, I guess along the whole line it makes sense to ask you, to what extent are you using existing rights of way?
So in essence, and the video kind of depicted this, the far northern portion of the route, which is basically from Pittsburgh at the Canadian border down to the COAS loop, which is about 40 miles, that is the new portion of the route. That's where we're either going underground, which will be for 8 miles of that distance, or through the working forest, which will be 24 miles of that distance, and then there's 8 miles of new right-of-way. Okay? Once you've gotten to the COAS loop, which is in Stark, the balance of the project follows existing rights-of-way all the way down to Deerfield, with the exception now of the 52 miles of underground construction around the White Mountain National Forest. One of the important things to recognize is from that point in Stark all the way to Deerfield, which is approximately 142 miles. We have an existing transmission corridor with an existing line that goes right through the White Mountain National Forest. Our plan is to follow that all the way to Deerfield, with the exception of the 52-mile underground construction around the White Mountain National Forest. So, the video indicated 80% of the line is either underground or on existing transmission right-of-way where there's an existing transmission line.
Following up on that, there's a question related to jobs and construction. There's a series of questions buried in here, not all of which I can read as clearly as some of the others, but I'm going to do my best to get this person's questions out there. It's really an opportunity for you to expand a little bit on what types of jobs, what kinds of skills are required for some of these construction jobs, but I'll do my best to read it. The proposal, you say, will bring more than 2,000 construction jobs to New Hampshire. Questions about the variety of jobs, what training's required, and what kinds of construction equipment will be necessary for the different types of construction that's going to be necessary along the route.
Okay. So there's a wide range of jobs. So it's a $1.6 billion infrastructure project. So that's a large undertaking. The range of jobs spans the gamut. It really starts from the electrical workers, the highly skilled craftsmen who will actually build the electrical line and do the electrical work, whether it's in a substation environment or the line itself. It is other physical workers who may have a role in creating an access road, clearing a right of way, delivering equipment. So those may be truck drivers, loggers, gravel suppliers. The gamut of physical work necessary to undertake a $1.6 billion infrastructure project. If you look beyond that, we expect there to be very significant second order effects to communities along the route, whether it's hotels who will house our workers, feed our workers, provide entertainment to the workers. These are all the effects that you see in these large types of infrastructure projects. How do we know that? We've got a lot of experience building similar projects in other states, whether it's in Connecticut, Massachusetts. There was a recent similar project built in the state of Maine. in which the job creation was quite dramatic. It's certainly a portion of that is highly skilled in the electrical work, but a portion of it also is going to be sourced very locally. So one of the commitments we've made is a New Hampshire First commitment. So to the extent possible, every one of those disciplines, we will look to New Hampshire residents and businesses and contractors first. And we're doing extensive outreach today up and down the route to identify who are the local companies who can play a role. And we've been very impressed by what's available in state. So the vast majority of this investment is going to be done locally.
Is there any chance that the project could expand to potentially, the word here is double, the power delivery? With such an abundance of hydropower north of the border, shouldn't we take more advantage of this clean, renewable energy, is the question.
So the short answer is no. In fact, we actually scaled down the size of the project. What was originally going to be a 1,200 megawatt line using a more conventional cable has been reduced to 1,090. Why did we do that? It was to be in a position where we can commit to 60 miles of underground construction. We were not comfortable with the state of technology in doing that with a 1,200 megawatt cable. So we actually changed the cable technology from a conventional cable to a state-of-the-art cable. We think that technology works at a 1,090. It's not been used at 1,200 megawatts. So we've actually scaled back the size of this project so that we can address one of New Hampshire's big needs. And I'll say this, the 60 miles of underground construction using this cable technology will be the longest underground construction in North America. So we're pushing the envelope technologically to meet the concerns of New Hampshire. As far as, would New England or New Hampshire be interested in more clean energy from Canada if it were available near a transmission path? I think it's a big part of the future. I really do. I think, if you look at what's happening on the supply side of generation here in the region, for us to keep prices low and meet our environmental goals, we're going to have to look to the future. So I would say, as a market, as a region, new renewables are a key part of the future, whether they're hydro, wind, or otherwise.
Related is another question that got submitted, which is that Hydro-Quebec already transmits some of its power into the New England grid. Why can't they just transmit more along their current lines? And I guess I'd like you to speak, if you can, about what other sources of hydro are coming into New England and along what transmission lines. Yeah.
So there's basically two sources of hydro in New England. You have small scale, generally run-of-river hydro. So these are the small dams you see throughout New England. They tend to be, 20 megawatts or less each. There are a lot of them. Those tend to operate when the rivers are flowing. There's another source of hydro in New England. It's called pumped hydro. So this was a technology that was in vogue back in the 70s and 80s. Essentially, you pump water up a mountain at night when costs are low, prices are low, and you let it run back through the turbines during the day when prices are high. A good example of that is Northfield Mountain in western Massachusetts. That's a second source of local hydro. So it's either run of river, just generally small, or large pump storage facilities. That's what you see locally. Most of our rivers throughout New England don't have a lot of additional capacity to generate electricity. Hydro-Quebec, on the other hand, has vast reservoirs and the ability to generate hydro power. So in one data point, Hydro-Quebec is about a 40,000 megawatt hydro generation fleet. All of New England's generation combined is about 35,000 megawatts. So they have more hydro today than New England has across coal, oil, nuclear, hydro, et cetera. There are two existing lines that interconnect Hydro-Quebec's grid with New England, one into New Hampshire and the other into Vermont. Those, in essence, are at capacity. So there's no additional ability to deliver large amounts of hydroelectric power over those lines, hence the need for a third line.
We've got a couple of more questions related to construction before changing the subject. In addition to the new transmission lines, what major upgrades will take place to improve the grid in the future?
Can you repeat that question, please?
In addition to the new transmission lines
yeah.
that you're proposing, what major upgrades will take place to improve the grid in the future?
Okay. So, you know, again, this project basically gets power to Deerfield, New Hampshire. That's the end point for all of this power, and it will all be delivered at that location. Separate and apart from this project, we, Eversource, and other utilities across New England are reinforcing our transmission infrastructure. And why are we doing that? In essence, we're doing it to make it more reliable. You could all remember some of the storms that have come through over the last 5 or 10 years. So we're building additional redundancy and resiliency into our system, but also we're making it more robust in the sense of our ability to move power seamlessly around the region. You know, 5 years ago, customers were paying hundreds of millions of dollars a year in what's referred to as congestion costs. That's because if you had generation in Maine and you couldn't get it to New Hampshire, it doesn't really do you any good. In the price differential between Maine and New Hampshire was referred to as congestion. And that was several hundred million dollar a year price tag for New England customers. Over the last 10 years, and we've done a lot of this, we've built out the grid so that that power could move seamlessly around New England, in essence, eliminating congestion. Those were investments we've been making over the last decade to allow that power flow. You know, we have a couple projects here in New Hampshire which will illustrate this point, one of which is pending before the SEC, so I won't speak about it, but that's the Merrimack Valley Reliability Project. The other is the Seacoast Reliability Project. It's, in essence, a project along the lines of what I just referred to. It's one that is will allow power to flow into the Seacoast area in an affordable way. The Seacoast is growing. There's a lot of business development. Customer demands are going up, and our ability to get the lowest cost power into that region reliably is tapped out. So we have a project which will open up the grid to allow power flowing into the Seacoast so that that area could continue to grow.
I have a more technical engineering question here. It is the question asker's understanding that a natural gas pipeline from Canada to Portland was built and buried through the North Country of New Hampshire. What are the logistical and engineering differences between burying a pipeline and burying your transmission lines?
Okay. I'm going to defer that to our technical team. Maybe, Ken, you could start.
Yeah, I'll start out, and then I'll also defer to Sam on some of this. Very familiar with constructing electric transmission, including underground, and the process is normally not done on rights of way. It's normally done in the public way, in city streets and state highways. So that's one difference between constructing gas pipelines. They're typically in a right of way either by themselves or in some cases co-located with overhead transmission lines. And Sam, maybe you can go into some of the construction methodology for gas transmission.
Sam Johnson, Burns & McDonnell Engineering. Basically, the construction of an underground trench for an electric line is really similar to that of a gas transmission line, with the exception of location. Gas transmission lines are typically built in rural areas or away from urban centers where possible, and they are by default also located next to transmission lines, again, to minimize impacts from additional clearing and other things. The one thing that will be noted is that because they are building a ditch effectively through the countryside, there are significant wetland impacts that occur, as well as significant amounts of directional drilling that needs to be done to get across water courses, et cetera. But effectively, the construction is relatively similar in its scope.
Yeah. And just to expand a bit, you know, it's very rare for there to be an interstate natural gas pipeline put in the public way, basically in the roadway. It's, you know, there's local distribution lines, small scale gas lines, but from a safety perspective, you know, burying a large interstate natural gas pipeline through a residential area in the public highways almost never occurs. If you look at Northern Pass, in contrast, when we worked to strike the balance and we said, let's develop an underground approach around the White Mountain National Forest, you know, one of the first areas we looked at is, should we build it right through our right-of-way where the existing transmission line is? And we quickly concluded that not only was it cost prohibitive, but the environmental impacts of us, in essence, blasting our way through the White Mountain National Forest to bury a transmission line defeated the purpose. It would have a very significant environmental impact. That led to our decision to go with underground construction in the public way around the White Mountain National Forest for 52 miles.
I think this is a related topic. There are some loaded questions on this sheet for you. Okay. Just I'll tell you that. How many people own property abutting routes 116 and 112, where Northern Pass now proposes to install underground lines?
Sam, do you have that answer readily available? So what we will do a calculation to figure that out.
The follow-up there is, how many abutters are there along the alternatives routes along I-93 through Franconia Notch?
And then, you're right, it's a loaded question.
Yeah, it gets better. Because the follow-up is, if you don't know, why don't you know? But I think your people can figure that out from the information you have, correct?
So I'm going to...
Please stop. Thank you very much.
So I'm going to defer the second question to Mr. Bose, who's been evaluating kind of route alternatives for us.
I think the essence of the question gets to, why don't we build along the I-93 corridor? I think that's the underlying question that people are trying to get to. And there's several reasons that make that a non-viable option. The first is public safety. The second is the environmental impacts of building along I-93. The third is the constructability, and the last is ultimately the project cost. There's a specific area that was mentioned in that question that is the Franconia Notch area, and I'd like Mark to actually address that. He's very knowledgeable about that and has spent many years of his career working on the Franconia Notch area.
And Mark, if you could introduce yourself, please.
My name is Mark Hodgson. I'm a private attorney. I spent 24 years in the Attorney General's office representing DOT, and for 14 years I was the Bureau Chief of the Transportation Bureau. Franconia Notch is environmentally, culturally, and legally not an option. It's non-viable. If you think about, in fact, I would say, without hesitation, Franconia Notch is the most environmentally and culturally sensitive place in this state. And I would say that, if you think about it, it's a notch, very confined area, and in that notch, just off the top of my head, you have Echo Lake, you have Profile Lake, you have Cannon Mountain State Park, you have the Old Man Historic Site, you have several geologic formations, including Boise Rock in the basin. You have a very fragile stone face up above, as the old man would testify if he was around. You have the Pemigewasset headwaters. You have the flume. In that confined space, you cannot do this level of construction without enormous impacts. And that I know just from common sense, but I also know it as a matter of law, because that area, Franconia Notch Parkway, was a result of 20 years of litigation resulting in a federal court consent decree. And that consent decree, which required, by the way, an act of Congress to get passed, the Norris-Cotton Amendment to the transportation bill allowed that to be constructed at two lanes, one in each direction, which is historically unheard of on the interstate. And that's because of the sensitivity of that area. Now, that agreement bars any further construction in the notch, period. And to the extent that even when DOT last did an overlay of pavement there, they weren't allowed to put in temporary pavement for detours. So doing this level of construction in the notch is legally just not a viable alternative. But more so, just as a citizen, I would say environmentally and culturally, the impacts are just too large.
A case for not constructing to Franconia Notch. And that leads us to the other two routes that were mentioned, as well as a couple others. We do have line lists and identified abutters for all of those properties. Sam just does not have them, you know, at his fingertips. We can certainly read those into the record at a later time. But that is a viable option, both technically feasible and, you know, at this level of 60 miles underground, economically viable.